Is it possible to have a Thanksgiving dinner made exclusively from ingredients grown or raised within 100 miles of your house? Maybe. But it takes effort for many people, too much effort. In this hour of midday, as Americans travel to gather and give thanks, we'll be talking about the food we eat, why so little of it comes from nearby farms. Spike Jurdy, the prominent Baltimore chef and restaurateur, has a lot to say about the importance of building a sustainable food culture right here in the Chesapeake region. So do representatives of an alliance called Future Harvest, including Lisa Duff, one of the graduates of its new farmer training program. Building a Chesapeake food shed and recruiting a new generation of farmers. On midday, after the news. Welcome back to Midday, everyone, our second hour. Dan Roderick's here. Thank you for making Midday part of your day and sticking around for the second hour. In doing some background reading for one of my Sun columns a couple of weeks ago, I came across some interesting facts about where our food comes from. You know, it's possible that for dinner tomorrow, a lot of Marylanders will have on their table root vegetables and squash that were grown in Maryland. That's quite possible, given the expansion in farmers' markets across the state and the popularity of them. It's possible that local eggs are in Thanksgiving recipes that call for eggs. But generally speaking, even with our efforts to be conscientious locavores, very little of the food we consume actually comes from the state in which we reside. Some interesting facts. Currently, just 3% of the country's farmland is used to grow and harvest fruit and vegetable crops. And it's less than 2.5% in Maryland. Farmers market farming, that kind of farming, is dwarfed by the big farming, soy, corn, wheat farming that goes on here, along with dairy and poultry. The farm-to-table movement is well established by now, but is it growing? Are we producing enough new farmers willing to commit their fields to the things we actually eat? Tomatoes and beans and squash and potatoes, asparagus, rhubarb. Can we change the food culture so that for most of the year, we Marylanders could buy produce from farms within, say, 100 miles of where we live? Is there potential for a new economy, new commerce from a regional food shed? I use that phrase. I love this term, food shed, as a play off the term watershed. An organization called Future Harvest is all over this topic. The full name of the group is Future Harvest, Chesapeake Alliance for Sustainable Agriculture. Its mission, building a sustainable food shed from farm and fishery to table. So Dina Liebman is with us. Dina Liebman is executive director, and she's joining us by phone today on this day before Thanksgiving. Dina, thank you for joining us here on Midday.
Hi, Dan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. And you're a farmer, too, right? Dina?
Yeah, well, I'm a beginner farmer.
You're a beginner.
I own a farm, yes.
Do you have goats and sheep, am I right?
Yes, goats and sheep and a hoop house full of produce in the summer. But there are people in Future Harvest who farm exclusively for their living, and so it's hard for me to say that I'm an actual farmer.
Okay. Well, you try at least. You got a little bit going on there. So Dean is joining us by phone. In the studio with us is Lisa Duff, who came down from Freeland, Maryland, in North Baltimore County, in her farm, Oak Spring Farm. She's joining us in the studio. She became a farmer, she says, about 6 years ago, now a sustainable farmer of organic vegetables and pastured eggs. Chickens out in the pasture. So, Lisa Duff, nice to meet you. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
And Spike Jurdy is here, one of Baltimore's most prominent chefs and restaurateurs. We're going to talk to Spike about cooking regional food, developing more growers for the farm-to-table movement here, and also answering my question. Spike, is it possible to prepare an entire Thanksgiving dinner with ingredients from within 100 miles of where we live here in Baltimore? Can you handle that for me today?
I'm happy to handle that.
Spike Jurdy, of course, of Woodbury Kitchen, Chew Fly Diner, Artifact Coffee, and Parts and Labor. So let me start with Dina, though. Dina, for folks who aren't familiar with Future Harvest, CASA, Chesapeake Alliance for Sustainable Agriculture. Just tell us a little bit about the organization first.
Okay. Well, I'll just call it Future Harvest to keep our name short.
Yeah, that's good for radio. Yeah.
We provide a voice for farmer-friendly, eco-friendly, and community-friendly agriculture in the Chesapeake region. Our members are small to mid-sized farmers in Maryland, Delaware, West Virginia, Virginia, and D.C. The organization started about 20 years ago, and it was founded by a group of farmers who were disgruntled, and this time they weren't disgruntled just about the weather, but the way agriculture was going in our region. They saw too many dead zones in the Chesapeake Bay caused by agricultural runoff, too many farms were unable to make ends meet and falling away to housing development, and there weren't enough markets for their food, the local and sustainably grown food. So they formed Future Harvest, and today this voice for local and sustainable food has grown into a great chorus. It's an incredibly exciting time to be part of the local food movement and building this food shed.
Okay. When we say food shed, you know, I've been using the radius of 100 miles. Is that what we're talking about, trying to produce food and make food accessible to people within, let's say, 100 miles of where they live, or maybe 200 miles? Is that what you mean?
Well, different people who source local food have different radiuses that they deal with. Anywhere between 100 and 200 miles is, you know, can be perceived as local food. It follows along the line from where the food is produced through distribution channels to our cities and our communities.
And Spike, Jody, I don't want to assume that we all understand why this is a good thing, okay? So maybe we ought to start with a basic question. Why is it a good thing to have fruits and vegetables coming to us from, say, within 100 miles of where we live?
The best place to start, I would say, because I think there are a lot of assumptions made about local and that it's just inherently good. And for us, certainly for us at Woodbury, I think we've come to understand that it's the direct relationship that you start with a grower, and then your ability to communicate, ask questions, and then make better decisions about the food that you're getting. That's the key, I think, and where local sourcing, direct sourcing, as we like to refer to it, starts to make sense and can actually be better. I think if you're just drawing a radius and saying my food comes from here, you may or may not be getting the benefit or the effect that you want. But being able to ask those questions, have a direct face-to-face relationship as often as you possibly can, and then make the best possible decisions about buying something based on the practice of your growers. In the case of Lisa, she's certified organic. That goes a long way for us. But we can also have a conversation about what that really means to her. Mm-hmm. And then I can make a decision about buying the produce. She was just dropping off at Woodbury this morning, so we obviously love what she's doing. And I think that's where it really starts to make sense.
Now, you're speaking as a restaurateur, mm-hmm. and a lot of people listening today are just shoppers, consumers, people cooking for their families
right.
or themselves, right? What about for them, though? What are the obvious – I don't want to say it's obvious. What are the benefits
of
this?
It's obvious. Well, the benefits are the same, and the way that you do it as the way that I do it or that anybody else does it is you join a CSA.
Community-supported agriculture.
All the yes. way, and you – you participate at any or all of the farmers markets that are around. And then there are places to buy produce that's locally grown. And
do we assume it's healthier? We're all assuming that if food that doesn't have to travel 1,000 miles to get to our tables is healthier, has more nutrients. Lisa, I'll go to you on that.
It's healthier for everybody. Mm-hmm. It's healthier for Mother Earth. It's healthier for my kids and my family, my community. It's healthier for the air, because food is traveling less. You know, the carbon footprint, people talk about that a lot and hear about that a lot. The carbon footprint of all local food is smaller. So things aren't coming from, not everything has to come from California or Guatemala mm-hmm. or Costa Rica. Mm-hmm. You know, yes, we still eat bananas, but I try to eat local apples, and we eat our produce 8 months a year. And that's what it's about.
Right. I mean, that's what it used to be. Too,
yes.
right? Dina, I'll go back to you on this. Dina Liebman, I read somewhere that Maryland had more than 300 tomato canneries at one time. I'm sure it wasn't only Marylanders eating all those tomatoes, but still, you could buy tomatoes and that were canned locally and keep them on your shelf. They came from Maryland. It was a Maryland product. So do you see at Future Harvest the opportunity for economic growth here, for a new economy, new commerce from a regional food shed, Dina?
Certainly. We see buying local and sustainable as solving great societal ills. People don't really understand how important it is. First, it grows the regional economy. A recent study by Penn State economists showed that direct sales from farmer to consumer are associated with a 9% increase in farmer income and contribute significantly to the overall agricultural economy. It's vital for keeping farmers on their land. And when you keep a farmer on his or her land, you are keeping that farm from falling prey to housing development. So it also fights urban sprawl. On top of that, it helps fight the obesity epidemic and malnutrition by providing nutritious, fresh food to our cities. And it keeps our kids connected to where our food comes from. Farms are also great education centers for school children, but also farmers teaching farmers about innovative practices. And because of this growing, vibrant regional food economy, more young people are interested in becoming farmers. And we have a beginner farmer training program. We've graduated nearly 50 new farmers. I think about 38 are still farming from that program. We get more applicants than we can handle because young people are seeing this now as a viable and really worthy career path.
Well, one of them is sitting in our studio, Lisa Duff from Oak Spring Farm in Freeland, in northern Baltimore County. So what were you in life before you were a farmer, like 7-8 years ago? What were you doing?
Oh, I was doing a lot of things in life before I became a farmer.
Well,
8 years ago, we moved here from Los Angeles. We moved to Freeland, Maryland.
Okay.
It was at the top of the housing market, and we just, sight unseen, bought our house, moved back.
Really?
5 acres, old farmhouse.
Moved back? You mean you lived here once?
I grew up in upstate New York.
Oh.
Very upstate
moved
New York.
To the East Coast.
Moved back to the East Coast. My
With an eye toward
Maryland.
Being a farmer?
No.
No.
Not so much.
What were you going to? What were you doing? What were you doing at the time?
I was a mom of two, so we had just had our second child. It was time to move back east, closer to family. We moved back east to this sight unseen farmhouse, five mm-hmm. acres. I wanted to get horses again. I grew up riding horses. Thought we'd get some chickens. And we got a call from the tax lady sometime in the winter after maybe 6 months we had lived at our farmhouse and had done lots of, you know, new windows, new things like this, putting money into the farmhouse. And she called and said, "Do you know that you're zoned agricultural?" I'm like, "Yeah, it's great. We can have goats and chickens and, you know, I can." She's like, "Right. And you have to show an income from your farm." Okay.
Or are you going to lose that
or
status?
Or you have to be residential.
Right.
So mm-hmm. I said, "Okay, you know what?" I said to my husband, Steve, "Honey, it's okay. I'll just sell some eggs. We'll get some chickens. I'll start a little garden and, you know, we'll just do this.
Show some income."
Because I had been a biology teacher. I had a garden club at my school. I had written a grant to get a greenhouse at the school I worked at in South LA. So I was already, I grew food in half barrels in my driveway in Southern California. So I've always liked to grow things. And he's like, "Okay, well, all right, that's what we'll do. Let's just get 6 chickens. And I got 25. And we had a small little garden with 5 tomato plants 1 year. And then the next year there were 25. And my friends started saying, "Hey, what are you going to do with all this stuff?" And I'm like, "Well, you can pay me some money and you can get a box of produce every week." My CSA started.
So you started a community supported agricultural program with
That's
your farm.
That's how I started.
And you call the farm Oak Spring Farm.
Yes, sir.
And now how many chickens do you have today as we speak? This is 6 years later.
I've cut back and we have 100.
100. Producing eggs?
Yes.
Fresh eggs, pastured eggs. And are you happy doing this? You seem happy.
I am so happy doing this.
Yeah.
I love this.
Has your husband gotten involved, or is it mostly you?
He's involved whether he wants to be or not.
We'll take a break and talk some more about this, okay? That's Lisa Duff, who is still a new farmer, 6 years in. She went through the beginner farmer training program of Future Harvest. Dina Liebman, executive director of Future Harvest, is with us. And Spike Jurdy is in the studio with us. If you have comments or questions about what we're talking about today, establishing this Chesapeake Regional Food Shed, there's a lot more to talk about here. 410-662-8780 is our local number. The Midday email address is midday@wypr.org. I'm going to ask Spike when we get back if you can make a Thanksgiving dinner completely from ingredients from Maryland or from within 100 miles of where you're cooking that dinner. A short break. We'll be right back. Spike has promised a recipe, too. There's a recipe coming from Woodbury Kitchen.
Yes.
What is it for, by the way?
It's a sweet potato casserole with Chesapeake oysters and bread pudding. It's awesome.
Oh, that sounds good.
It's sweet really good. Potatoes, and oysters, and bread
and
pudding.
And savory bread pudding on top.
Mm. Ooh.
Yeah.
Spike.
It's going to be on the table tomorrow at a...
Is just the recipe coming over, not the dish itself? It's all right. So my question was, everybody goes to the supermarket and does their shopping for Thanksgiving dinner, and you pile up the potatoes. What else? Squash. Some kind of squash, right?
Butternut squash.
Maybe some beans, some Brussels sprouts.
Some sauerkraut if you're in Maryland.
Sauerkraut if you're here, right? A turkey,
yes.
Of course. Cranberry sauce comes in a can, or you can get the cranberries themselves and make your own sauce at home. Okay. So most of that, if you go to a Safeway, a Giant, a big supermarket, most of that is probably coming from someplace else, right?
Right.
We agree with that?
Yep.
That's probably true?
Well,
and people will buy them without even thinking about the source necessarily.
The reality is
that
in a large-scale food system, you don't really know where it's coming from. So it hasn't been a feature of the way that we've thought about food for a long time to really ask or care that much about or ask that we be told. So I think another advantage, I think, to be able to have that conversation and to know whether it's farmer's market or whatever, where your food's coming from is huge.
Right.
So
we know the potatoes probably come from Idaho, right? But you could, if you're lucky. So you're not sure. You're not sure. You're never
not sure.
Okay.
And there are some things that are coming from a lot farther away than we probably realize.
Yeah.
Garlic is very little garlic is grown in the state of Maryland. Correspondingly, little garlic in our food system is grown in the United States anymore. And so, the garlic that you're eating has probably come from China.
At your restaurant, at Woodbury Kitchen and the other restaurants, you actually have all these contacts you mentioned before. It's quite extensive now of providers, right?
It's a real community around food.
And how far away is the most distant one, I would say?
The farthest one that we have a direct relationship with, I would say, is Anson Mills down in South Carolina. And we get
what do they provide for you?
Grits, rice, which we do a little bit of. But we're finding, we've dialed it in over time, and we're finding more local sources for a lot of these things. We maintain that relationship because Glenn Roberts is a real visionary around a lot of this stuff. Mm-hmm. But we now get grits from a great farmer, from a farm who grows and mills grits and polenta, and we get whole corn, field corn from him in Pennsylvania. We get amazing whole wheat and whole rye, both the whole grain and also flour from a farm in Southern Maryland called Next Step Organics. Amazing, amazing stuff he's doing. In addition to Heinz, he's kind of an icon.
And let me stop you there. In that case of that, what's the name of the place in Southern Maryland?
Next Step Organics.
Next Step. Okay.
Yeah.
So they're at the stage where they can supply you or a bakery.
Is he
supplying stores? I mean, if I wanted to buy it, if the average consumer wanted that product, how would you get it?
Well, it's on the shelves at Parts and Labor at the butcher shop there.
That's your place.
Yes.
Farmers markets.
Farmers markets.
But he shows up at farmers markets. Okay, so this leads me to this question about breaking through. And Dina, if you want to step in here, just feel free. Breaking through and creating sort of a new culture about food, where it comes from. Not only an economy, but a way of thinking about it, right? How do you get that through to people who are used to going to supermarkets and maybe to the farmer's market for a few months each year and don't really depend on it all year round? So, Dina, can you address that a little bit?
Yeah. The key is education, and it's different kinds of education, from teaching kids in elementary school to teaching food lovers to providing nutrition programs for residents in of food desert areas. That's areas without access to fresh food, in mostly in our inner cities. And that's what Future Harvest focuses a lot on, is peer-to-peer education, not only farmer teaching farmer about practices that protect land and water, but also for consumers on how to source locally and sustainably. And that's why we partner with Spike. He's been a great partner and is very interested in teaching other chefs on how to procure locally and how to design their kitchens differently. I mean, it's a big commitment. It's why we run the Beginner Farmer Training Program, and Lisa can talk about that. But we think it really all boils down to education.
Okay, education. The thing that comes to mind for me is branding. I'll throw this in this idea in there. You know, we live in this great region of the country, the Chesapeake region, right? We have the Delmarva over there, this big landmass that's used to produce lots of soy and corn, stuff that we don't eat directly, right? The idea of changing that, getting more farmers to produce food that we actually eat and having it branded, not just local, but, you know, sort of Chesapeake, regional food, the idea that if I'm buying these potatoes, they're coming from a farm on the Eastern Shore or maybe in Western Maryland, and I'm supporting the local economy too. That's, to me, you know, it's like a cultural breakthrough in the way you think about food.
Absolutely. And once you, but the great news, I think, is once you start down that path, it becomes more and more natural.
Absolutely.
I think at Woodbury, we don't have a second thought about what's available to us right now in the season or at any time of the year.
So you can do a Thanksgiving dinner pretty much with all local ingredients within your food shed.
Yeah. Everything that we, going back to that radius thing, everything for us, virtually everything is within 50 miles. Just not because we've set that radius, but that's just how it's worked out. And we have maps that kind of show where everything's coming from. The one exception, which I'm actually really proud of, is salt. Because we have a local source, local to us, I think. It's in West Virginia, just outside of Charleston. And so we're now, for Woodbury, we're getting all of our salt from this one source.
Is there a salt mine in West Virginia?
It's a salt brine well.
And it's actually an
area in the country where a lot of salt production was in the 1800s that fell off as other cheaper sources were found. And this woman has single-handedly kind of brought salt production back to the valley outside of Charleston, West Virginia.
What about a turkey?
Easy.
Easy? No, I'm serious.
No,
where do you get a local turkey?
I think we almost have our origin myth around turkeys now. It was the chef from the Maryland Club asked David Smith at Springfield Farm, you know, why don't you grow some turkeys?
And where is that, Spike, Springfield Farm?
Straight north of here in Baltimore County.
Okay.
And he's, you know, the Smith family has been on that farm for a long time, and they're among, I think that we could say now, the pioneers, now that we have a little collective a few years under our belt. He really got a lot of things going, and one of the things he started doing was growing heritage turkeys up there. And now there are many, many other growers.
And they available to consumers? I mean,
yes.
Are they available to the retail level?
Almost everybody that's doing turkeys will sell them to you directly, and they will have arrange a pickup, you know, yesterday or today to pick up your turkeys, and you're off to the races.
Okay.
I know that you can pick up on many of these farms.
Lisa, you're nodding there. So all of this can be done. You need to work at it. And this, you know, this breakthrough I'm talking about is making it easier and more accessible for people. The only way to do that is have more farmers producing more, right?
Well, it is accessible, but people need to want to do it first.
Yeah.
You have to start by starting.
Yeah.
And once you get in the groove of going to the farmer's market or in a CSA, then you have all these contacts. And then you see all, like Lynn Ferguson.
I'm going up on the next level where it becomes easier for people just to go to the store and see more local produce, and not just in the summertime when the apples at Giant say local on them and the peaches, right?
We're working at it.
I know. So I just wonder what does it take? What does it take to get there? That's one of the questions I have.
Scale.
More farmers.
Yep.
So I'm sorry, Dina, you say you have plenty of applicants for new farmers.
Yes, we do. And we're getting higher and higher quality applications of people who have a little farming experience under their belt and who really want to take it to the next level. We have older people who want to get in as second careers, who've had it with working in the city and want to get out there and see this as viable for making a living. It's not just a pastime, but it's really a solid way of making a living. It's hard, but it can be done.
Lisa, can you talk about making a living? I mean, you're selling eggs now, and you've been selling organic vegetables. You go to the Hereford Farmers Market mostly?
Yes, I do. And I am working at making a living at this. My husband has an off-farm job, and that's how we pay our mortgage. But I've been working over the last 6 years, and especially in the last 2 years since I graduated from the Beginner Farmer Training Program, to make a real go at making a fair wage for myself. It does take a lot of work. It's a lot of hard work and a lot of hours for, you know, a basic income.
At first, were you thinking that way about it? You thought maybe it was just going to be a hobby. I'll make a little bit of money to show the tax lady that
I was trying to make my revenue. $2,500 to show the tax lady and be fair and honest so we didn't have to say we made it on our taxes.
Right.
And so it's evolved from there.
It's evolved. And would you say you're making a profit?
I am. I'm making a profit this year better than I made last year. I did make a profit last year, and I even made a small profit the year before. But profit being, you know, that's not counting paying the mortgage of our house and our entire farm.
Right.
So it's the profit of my small
business.
That is why I have the husband. Well, there's a lot of reasons.
I understand that. But you would say if you were on your own, if you just for yourself, you would have had a decent living this past year. Getting close.
I could eke out a small living if I had leased land that was local.
Okay. Which is saying something because, you know, less than 2.5% of the farms that actually grow food for people, those are mostly operating at a loss. I mean, it's the number is somewhere around $5,000 net loss for small farms that are growing food for people to eat, the farms that we're talking about. And so that's why it's really important that we have groups like Future Harvest really focusing on bringing not just dollars back to farmers like Lisa, but real profitability to farms so that they can stay on the land.
Dina, I have another question for you about farmers. Do we have any farmers in Maryland who have gone from just growing corn and or soy or wheat to actually producing more produce for farmers markets?
Yes. I'm trying to think of a specific example, but yeah, it has for the past 20 years been the other way, but actually a lot of young people are coming back from college and taking over their family farms and putting them into fruit, vegetable, and livestock production. Livestock, we have to bring that into the conversation. That's pastured livestock, which is livestock that's taken out of the buildings, out of the barns, and put onto pasture, which is a more environmentally friendly way of growing them and also develops a more nutritious product. I think Smith Meadows Farms in Virginia, there's farms on the Eastern Shore, that usually it's being driven by new and young farmers who want to do this, who don't want to grow crops for export.
I don't have it in front of me, but a report that I read about the potential of profit for growing fruits and vegetables for the market, for the regional market, this food shed that we're talking about, that can include, you know, New York City, Washington, D.C., was pretty impressive, the potential for it.
It is. There's huge potential. But what it comes down to is economy of scale. And, you know, you have that with export crops, corn and soybean, but it has not been redeveloped for fruits and vegetables. So that's why a phenomenon is growing up called food hubs. And these are aggregators of fresh and local produce, and they come in different models. They can be for-profit or non-profit. What they do is they aggregate produce at a small, very small markup for the farmer, and then they scale up to the point where they can sell to the wholesale market in cities. And this is turning around communities around the country. It's been very successful in Virginia. We've got a for-profit model, Blue Ridge Produce, the local food hub, I think it's in Richmond. There's one in Charlottesville, and there's several springing up around Maryland. And these are absolutely key. And what this brings back is that rural cooperative that also not only makes it economically, provides yet another outlet for the farmer, but it also provides a bringing together of farmers as well. And the nonprofits usually have an education mission associated with them as well, of new farmer incubator program.
Well, Dina, that's actually how I got into this, because I was looking at Cleo Braver's proposal for a food hub in Easton over in Talbot County. It's a very interesting idea to aggregate, say, you know, the reference I made before to tomatoes, you know, the idea that you could have acres and acres of tomatoes again in Maryland, aggregate them at a warehouse of some kind, a hub, a food hub, maybe even make tomato sauce. I don't know what you'd do there.
Yeah, we
can them, and then you've got Maryland Eastern Shore tomatoes again, Chesapeake branded tomatoes again to sell to whoever up and down the East Coast.
Which is we've been doing that at Woodbury for quite some time, and this year we got up to around 40,000 pounds of tomatoes that we canned.
Did you really?
Yeah.
And you save them all year. You save it and use it in your cooking all year, and you sell.
Right.
Do you sell it also?
No, not yet.
You don't sell.
We have a couple products. We do a lot of jams and jellies for sale. A little bit of tomato
and the hot sauce.
And the hot sauce.
Right. So you do sell some products, but the tomatoes are mostly for your restaurants.
Yeah.
Right.
And that'll all end up, if you're having a tomato sauce at Woodbury or Parts and Labor, Shoe Flyer Artifact, it'll be a Maryland tomato.
In January
that we can.
So who cans it for you? Excuse me. I'm just curious. Where is that done, in state or out of state?
It's in our kitchen at Shoe Fly.
Oh, you mean you do the old-fashioned kind of, with the boiling water and all that?
Yep.
Spike, really?
Yeah, all of it.
We have to take a break. Listen, folks, I hope you're enjoying this discussion about food, where it comes from. And we have Spike's recipe that was sent over to us from Woodbury Kitchen, Chesapeake Oyster Casserole. Why don't we talk about it a little bit when we get back?
Sure.
And then we'll post it. So, folks, if they're looking for a good recipe for tomorrow, you can still get some oysters. There's still time.
Oh, yeah.
410-662-8780. Please join the conversation. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Midday as we're talking about Future Harvest, this Alliance for Sustainable Agriculture here in the Chesapeake region. Dina Liebman is the executive director. Lisa Duff has her own farm in Freeland, Maryland, Oak Spring Farm. She went through the training program for new farmers that's put on each year by Future Harvest. And also, Future Harvest has a conference coming up in January, a convention at College Park that we're going to tell you about. Spike Jurdy is with us from Woodbury Kitchen, Shoe Fly Diner, Artifact Coffee, and Parts and Labor, and is sharing a recipe with us. We're going to talk about that in just a minute. Let's take a couple of calls. And Dina, if you want to add to this, any comments after the caller gets off, feel free. Christina in Sparks, welcome to Midday, Christina.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. And of the three things I was going to say, Spike has already handled one of them, which was that he makes his own and cans stuff all the time. If you're in the restaurant, you can see the jars on the walls. Initially, I thought they were just decoration.
That's what I thought.
but they rent a warehouse where they store. I mean, they got tons of jars canned. I love it. You mentioned earlier about, you know, Lisa was talking about how much money she could make. I have been getting a CSA from Calvert's Gift Farm for maybe 10 years now, and Jack and Becky Gurley have been able to stop working their regular jobs and have raised a family of four by their small organic farm, selling to restaurants and selling to CSAs. So it absolutely can be financially viable.
Christina,
so I think that's important.
Yeah, thank you very much for mentioning that. It's good to hear that. And so you rely primarily on the Hereford Farmers Market, Lisa? Is that your main place for selling? That's where you meet your CSA folks?
And primarily, I'm a CSA farm, and I started with the CSA.
Okay,
and then
so you don't
market.
So you don't necessarily sell at the market?
I do sell at
oh,
the
you
market.
Do sell.
I sell at the market. I have a CSA, and then I sell to restaurants, mostly
oh.
Spike's restaurants
okay.
right now. But
in terms of, I was curious, organic vegetables, like what did you, this past year, how did it go, and what did you grow? Could you mention?
Sure. I grow like 35 to 40 different crops. I mean,
really?
I have 10 different kinds of tomatoes, lots of cherry tomatoes, sun gold tomatoes. What I brought down today was red cabbage, green cabbage, salad mix, you know, baby lettuces that are coming from the hoop house. I grew three different kinds of carrots. There's, you know,
leeks?
Kale, all kinds. Of, oh, sure. Leeks, kale,
leeks.
Onions.
What's still in the ground? Is anything still in the ground?
There's some carrots in the ground. I harvested the last of the cabbages yesterday. There's still some broccoli plants, but the frost last week hit them. But I had broccoli up until just then.
Let's take another call. Brandon in Upperco with a question about beginning farming. Hello, Brandon.
Hi, how are you, Dan?
Good.
I had a question. Just, it's very intimidating when you're starting out farming to sell your vegetables. I think the farmers markets have a lot of older established farms. I know Woodbury works with a lot of established farms. Is Future Harvest doing anything to maybe help us take that leap and just give us the confidence to know that we'll be able to sell our vegetables?
Dina, go ahead.
Yes, and I know exactly how you feel as somebody who's just starting to venture myself into selling. It can be incredibly intimidating. I suggest you start at our conference January 15th through 17th. We have seven tracks for farmers, and there's one just for people starting out, and it has all sorts of networking with farmers and also people who buy from farmers, and it's just a great place to hear from other people how they got started, walking into restaurants, developing those relationships. That conference is the launch of the whole year's worth of education programming. Aside from the Beginner Farmer Training Program, Future Harvest runs field education on farms and in food businesses throughout the year along those seven tracks. So the public can come to those. We have consumer education. We have technical education for farmers on how to grow more sustainably. We have marketing track for people who want to learn how to market.
This is January 15th through 17th at College Park at the Marriott Hotel and Conference Center.
Yeah, it's called Cultivate the Chesapeake Food Shed. Spike is our keynote, and we have beginner farmers coming. I hope Lisa's coming.
Of course.
And it's hundreds of farmers and food lovers and food businesses all from all over the Chesapeake State. And then again, that education goes throughout the year. So there are tons of young farmers there or new farmers who want to learn from others on how to break into those markets.
Okay, Dina, thank you. We'll take another call now. Krista in Lutherville, welcome to Midday. Hi.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, go right ahead, please.
Great. Hi, Lisa, it's Krista.
Hi, Krista.
It's been a long time. I was so happy to hear that you're on the radio.
Is this a customer of yours?
Helper. Volunteer / intern, hopefully for next year, too.
Oh, you get volunteers and interns. Are you a future farmer, Krista?
Yes, I will be. In fact, I just found out yesterday that I was accepted into the University of Vermont Farmer Training Program. So very unfortunately, I'm going to be moving. But I have to say that a lot of it has to do with the experience that I had at Lisa's farm this summer. Even though it was short and sweet, I really wanted it to be longer, but pretty much for the month of August, I got to help her and her other staff with harvesting those golden sun tomatoes that she was talking about. Absolutely exquisite, some of the best I've ever had in my life. I also got to get a really good glimpse of what it would be like to manage a farm of that size and the different varieties of products that she has and the small animals. And it's a beautiful spot. I wish more people could have access to it. And I hope that after the show, she gets lots more people for her CSA because the food is just delicious.
Krista, so what is your ambition? What kind of farming?
I really want to get into small-scale farming, very similar to the way that Lisa has hers set up, maybe 5 to 10 acres. Organic vegetables, small animals. I'm interested in chickens and goats and who knows what else. It's going to really depend on what I'm good at. Definitely going to grow some tomatoes, probably not as many as she has, because it's you need a small army to pick all those. Wow, was that an unbelievable experience, but it was great. I enjoyed every minute of it.
All right, well, good luck to you, Krista, and thank you for calling.
Thank you.
Good luck, Krista.
I asked you what kind of a year it was for you. I mean, just in terms of the growing season of 2014, what would you say generally about it?
It was great. The weather was beautiful. Yeah, we had just the right amount of rain. It was really a good growing season.
Spike, you want to talk about the recipe a little bit?
Sure.
It's the day before Thanksgiving, Spike has contributed a recipe that you might want to consider for tomorrow, a Chesapeake oyster casserole, 3 sweet potatoes, 3 cups of half and half, 4 eggs, probably from Oak Spring Farm.
If you're lucky, yeah.
1 sprig each of rosemary and sage, 1 clove of garlic crushed, 3 cups of stale bread, half of a large loaf, 12 farmed Chesapeake oysters shucked, which you can find in a jar now, right?
Mm-hmm.
And some salt and pepper. So I don't want to give it all away. We don't read the whole recipe on the air, but basically, what are you doing with all those ingredients?
You're going to take the half and half, simmer the sweet potatoes that are peeled and sliced just briefly, layer those in a baking dish, take that same cream that you kind of started the sweet potatoes in and whisk the eggs into that, and then put the full kind of stir the bread into that kind of custard mixture, and that becomes a top layer. And then just put the oysters on top of the sweet potatoes, the kind of the bread pudding that you now have, the savory bread pudding that's been infused with the rosemary and sage, over all that, and bake it in the oven for about 45 minutes.
The bread is on the top. And then you bake it.
And it sets, and the bread kind of toasts and gets golden brown, and it's really beautiful. Take a beautiful slice of that out of there, and there's and kind of the oysters in the middle as the little surprise, and it's all, like you said, it's all Chesapeake.
That might make me like sweet potatoes more than I do now. I mean, they're okay.
Yeah.
I eat sweet potatoes a couple times a year. I'm not a big sweet, but oysters
this
in
gets
there,
it all together.
That's pretty good, Spike. Is this yours, by the way?
It is. We did this.
Congratulations,
we did this at the
boy.
Farmer's market on Sunday and got everything for the recipe at the farmer's market.
Okay. So what we'll do is we'll post it on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. We'll post it on the WYPR midday page on our website, and also we have a PDF of this. We can send that out to anybody who desperately needs it this afternoon.
It's easy
because
they
like the idea. It didn't sound that hard. Yeah. We should take a couple more calls here. Santa Barbara, California. Is that right, John in Santa Barbara, California? Is this somebody you know? Is this Old Home Week here or something?
It sounds like it's turning into that. Yeah.
All right. Sorry. Go ahead, John. Hello. Welcome
to
the
Dan.
Show. Yeah.
Hello.
Hi.
Mike.
Yeah.
How are you doing, John?
Not too bad. Trying to suffer through the weather out here. But
is this an old friend of yours, Spike?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it is.
John, what's your story? Did you used to work with Spike? You used to be in Baltimore?
I've worked on Spike for a long time. I'm a Baltimore native, born and raised, church hospital before they tore it down. But, yeah, a friend of Spike's from the old times. But I have a question of Spike that I've never asked him, and since he won't answer my text messages... What food
is
can you
a
not
stalker?
Get involved with that you expect you would be able to get?
What is the most surprising food that you can get locally that you didn't think you could get? You mentioned salt. That was pretty cool. I don't think anybody would expect, you know, local salt, at least West Virginia salt. I mean,
so we are I'd say top of mind cardoons from Jack and Becky Gurley, a great obscure kind of Mediterranean vegetable related to artichokes. Artichokes themselves we got this year from Chesley Farm for the first time. It was a program that was introduced to try to get farmers to stop growing tobacco and start growing artichokes. Nobody bit except those guys, but they're not tobacco farmers, but that was amazing. And I would say the bitter lemons that we get from Heinz, just because we've tried to reduce, i.e. eliminate the amount of citrus that we use in the restaurants, and we get these incredible little bitter lemons that we can use to add a citrus flavor to things.
Very good.
How about that, John?
Yeah, all right, John. Thank you for that. Thank you.
Is there something that you thought you would be able to get but you can't get?
He sounds a little surprised.
He wants more.
You're surprised?
What?
That you could get that.
I think those things have been revelations to us.
Okay. Let's take another call. Betsy in Freeland, up where in your neck of the woods, Lisa. Hi, Betsy.
Heathcote. Hey, everybody. I'm up here watching it snow on my 100-foot timber-framed high tunnel, which is built with wood that we cut down to clear the land for the high tunnel.
So it's kind of cool.
You're on a farm, I assume. You're talking
we
about...
We are, exactly. We are a permaculture demonstration farm. Permaculture stands for permanent agriculture as well as permaculture. We are CASA members. I've been to their programs. I just love them. And I learned something from them a couple of years ago, that Wednesday afternoon farmers markets can be very successful. So I am partnering with my associates at Penmar Human Services. They provide services for adults with disabilities. I have a small grant to convert part of our farm into a garden for, it's going to be wheelchair accessible.
Hmm.
And we are looking to open a farmers market here in Freeland in spring of 2016. Which will give the Penmar folks a way to, have some fun doing a farmer's market. And we're inviting Lisa and Brandon and anybody else who wants to be part of the market to get in touch with me.
Okay. That's interesting. Thanks for letting us know about that, Betsy. So that's called Heathcote Community Farm, is that right?
Right. It's part of Heathcote Community, which is an intentional
community. Heathcote. Yeah. Heathcote. Yeah. He left it in the closet here last year. No, it's Heathcote. Community farm, right? Have we got it right?
From this area.
All right, Betsy. Yeah, thank you for calling that in. Happy Thanksgiving to you.
Oh, thanks so much, guys.
Yeah, and I want to say happy Thanksgiving also to Spike Jurdy for being here today and for providing this great-looking recipe, Chesapeake Oyster Casserole, which you can find on our Facebook page shortly after we get off the air here. And Lisa Duff, congratulations to you.
Thank
on
you.
Another year of farming, following your bliss out there at Oak Spring Farm with your chickens. And happy Thanksgiving to you and your family.
Same to you.
Dina Liebman, thank you for making time for us today, Dina. Good luck with the Future Harvest. And there's information about your conference in January also on our Facebook page.
Thank you, Dan.
All right, Dina.
A real pleasure.
Yeah. Happy Thanksgiving to you. Listen, we're going to end with an Alan Sherman song. I don't know if anybody remembers Alan Sherman. He was a very funny satirical songwriter from the early 60s, and he's got a little song here about, you know, traveling home, the end of the season, he was a salesman, the end of the season, he comes home for Thanksgiving maybe, or whatever it is, and you're back in the loving arms of family and friends. A lot of people will have that experience in the next 24 hours or so. So we thought we'd send you off with this.
I sell a line of plastics, and I travel on the road, and I have a case of samples, which, believe me, is a load. Every night a strange cafe, a strange hotel, and then early in the morning, I am on the road again. When the season's over and my lonesome journey ends, that's the only time I see my family and my friends. I drive up Ocean Parkway, and before I stop the car, my ma leans out the window and she hollers, "Here we are." Shake hands with your Uncle Max, my boy, and here is your sister Cheryl, and here is your cousin Isabel, that's Irving's oldest girl. And you remember the Tishman twins, Gerald and Jerome. We all came out to greet you and to wish you welcome home. Meet Merowitz, Barowitz, Handelman, Shandelman, Sperber and Gerber and Steiner and Stone, Moskowitz, Lupowitz, Aronson, Berenson, Kleinman and Feynman and Friedman and Cohn, Smolowitz, Wallowitz, Teitelbaum, Mandelbaum, Levin, Levinsky, Levine and Levi, Brumberger, Schlumberger, Minkus and Pincus and Stein with an E-I and Stein with a Y. Shake hands with your Uncle Sal, mine boy, and here is your brother Sid, and here is your cousin Yetta, who expects another kid. Whenever you're on the road, mine boy, wherever you may roam, we'll all be here when you come back to wish you